Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Today is Sunday, April 2nd, 2006, and this is show number 37. Well, it rained all day Saturday, but today was a beautiful day on Sunday, so even though I knew it's going to rain about an inch Monday and Tuesday, I washed not just my car, but also my daughter's car, and while I waxed her car a little bit and vacuumed and all that. But hey, for a whole day, I'm going to have a clean car. Only one in town. The obsession continues. Well, hey, last week I forgot to do a new country update. Last week and this week combined, we added four more countries, so I guess we're not out of them yet. We added Mongolia, Morocco, Sri Lanka, and French Polynesia to the listening audience. I have a soft spot in my heart for French Polynesia because my husband and I spent our honeymoon in Tahiti. In 2 years, we're going to hit 25 years of marriage, and we plan to go back. I can't wait. The water is just amazing there. It's so warm and so clear, like nothing I've ever seen. It's a perfect place for a honeymoon, let it be your first or your second. Well, I have a correction to make from last week's podcast. My thrilling piece on the RPN calculator I use was met with much enthusiasm by the listening audience. It warms my heart that so many of you as geeky as me. Several of you wrote in to tell me about it. However, Quality Assurance Director Steve pointed out an error I made in my description of how to use the RPN calculator. To review, I said in the cast that to run the calculation 2 times the quantity 3 plus 5, you would type in 2 enter, 3 enter, 5 plus into an RPN calculator, and that is incorrect. I forgot the final operation, which does the multiplication of the 2 factor. The correct thing you should type is 2 enter, 3 enter, 5 plus times. Ironically, this makes it the same number of keystrokes as a traditional calculator, which completely defeats my argument. But still, trust me, there's a lot of calculations for which the RPN calculator is more efficient. I just haven't come up with one right this minute. In spite of QA Director Steve's pickiness, listener Mike pointed out in an email that before computers got faster, they used RPN to perform complex math because it's the best way of following the order of operations and simplifying complex math algorithms using a stack. So there, QA Director Steve. Got a lot of listener feedback this week. Listener Laurel wrote in, and I think you should all take a lesson from her on how to address your emails to me. She addressed it to Almighty Podcaster. I think that has a nice ring to it, don't you? Anyway, Laurel teaches digital graphics, drawing, and painting, and has been wanting to create a podcast in the classroom for her students who miss class and for others who may be interested in logging on. I think this is one of the coolest uses for podcast. It can be an enhancement to an existing material or a repeat of the material to understand it in greater depth, or it could be used for those who missed a class. I've heard a lot of people debating about if we do all the classwork as podcasts, then nobody's going to show up to the class. But the way I look at it is, if you make your material as accessible as you can and the ways people want to receive it, you're going to reach a broader audience. Being obsessed about forcing them to show up and making sure they want to hear it the way you want to present it is not as important as thinking of them as your customers and how could they most easily get the information you want to give them. Laurel's not quite ready to get off the ground on the podcasting idea yet, but is interested in advice on designing the website before she gets started. I gave her some advice that I'd like to share with you, too. It seems that actually the traditional kind of website is sort of dying out. Traditional websites are more static, but those are being replaced by what they call content management systems. That's a fancy phrase that really means an easy-to-update website that assumes you're going to provide new content on a regular basis. The central part of these kind of sites are blogs, which is just a text area where you can yap about what's interesting to you. It's now common to have a podcast within that blog as well, but you don't necessarily have to do that. The cool thing about these content management systems is that they do all the organization work for you. For example, on podfeet.com, I use a tool called WordPress. And you know how on podfeet.com you can see the archives down on the right side sorted by month? I don't do anything to make that happen. WordPress just does that all by itself. I was really excited when I saw it was there. I didn't put in the search section either. WordPress did that all on its own. The nice pretty titles of each blog entry are all done by WordPress, And the cool way there's a link to read the rest of the entry is all from WordPress too. I have to actually push a button to do that, but the rest of it's all there by just automatically. In fact, I don't know how to make it stop if I wanted to. WordPress and these kind of systems run on the server itself, not on your local machine, which is cool because you don't have to download an application and worry, is it going to be compatible with your operating system or whatever. It's all running on the server side. So any operating system, if you use Linux or Mac or Windows, whatever, it's going to work for you. I use VisiWeb as my host. I'm ambivalent on whether you should choose them yourself, but they provide WordPress with the package that I pay for. I only pay like $7 a month, and they provide that with the package on the Linux servers that they use. And, of course, WordPress is open source, so it's all free. Another major nifty feature is that if you get tired of the look of your website, you can just swap it out in an instant. The look of the site is called a theme, and if you want to switch themes, you download a new theme to your web host and then literally click a button, and suddenly your website looks completely different. All your content stays there. It's just all of the colors and text and graphics and side panels move around and change their look. I could put a couple of pictures in the show notes to show you what I mean. I took a snapshot of the normal look of podfeet.com. I clicked a button to switch to a different theme, took a snapshot of it, and clicked it right back. With any luck, none of you noticed I was screwing around with it, but it was literally maybe 30 seconds in between the two views. So you can see what I'm talking about. I have not by any means gotten the hang of this whole content management system thing yet. I have a lot to learn, but the good thing is that WordPress has a fantastic community. There's a wiki with tons of instructions and people willing to help. Someday I'm going to get improvements done to the site. Like, I really want to figure out how to make the text area wider. I got a buddy of mine working on that, but it feels cramped at only 500 pixels wide to me. A lot of times I have to shrink the pictures down to where it's kind of hard to see what I was trying to point out in a photo, but I can't fit anything wider in there. I did try to change it in the theme myself, but I horked it up like you wouldn't believe. The way I kind of work on this sort of thing is I'm kind of like a mechanic that has a bucket of parts and a working car next to them, and they go, well, I don't know, maybe if I put it together like this, this will look sort of like that. And it's amazing how much progress I make with that bucket of parts method. But you can't believe how bad it looked when I changed the width of the screen. It just was very strange. So I clearly don't understand how it works. I keep meaning to read more instructions, but somehow I never quite get around to it. I pick up a new gadget or something. Anyway, check out themes.wordpress.net, which is an easy way, a great place to flip through a bunch of beautiful themes to see what you like. There's like 430-something of them in there, and you can just click on them, and you're going to see the same content provided over and over and over again, but in a completely different theme. So it really illustrates what I'm talking about. Listener Susan wrote in and chatted with me about her tablet PC, and I've always been curious about people who do use tablet PCs. What do they use it for, and how does it provide value to them? Because I haven't actually had a lot of experience with it myself. I played with one once, but that's about it. So I asked her, why does she like her tablet PC? And I'm going to read her review directly. So here's what she says. My model, the Toshiba Satellite, is a full laptop with a convertible screen, so the keyboard is always there, not like the tablet-only ones. Knowing you're a geek, I can tell it's sometimes nice to fold up the PC and take it off to a couch or bed and lie comfortably to listen to podcasts or radio or CD or whatever. Warm, too. Doesn't require a light, just a pen. I like to take notes when I'm listening to something serious, like a lengthy instructional CD or a longish podcast interview, like from KQED or Open Source or other CNN or NPR shows. So writing on the screen in sticky notes or OneNote is easy and natural. Sometimes I print the notes. Sometimes they're just there to remind me as I go back to the notes. I never got handwriting recognition to work beyond every other word. Ditto for speech recognition, but the capability is there. Sometimes I do record short audio notes to go along with the text. The tablet is great for sitting on a plane or in a crowded auditorium, too. At Gnomedex, there were 300 mostly 30-somethings all hunched over their laptop screens, blogging their brains out, while I was leaned back in my chair writing on my screen. Not that I could read all my writing, but I was quite comfortable. One aggregator guy seated nearby leaned over to me and said, "Hey lady, you have a really cool machine. Made my day." For eyesight reasons, it's often easier to adjust the computer to the lighting than adjusting my body, head, and eyes to the computer as long as I'm not in typing mode. The on-screen keyboard suffices for entering URLs and search terms into a browser with a pen in place of a mouse. I haven't done much with the pen and drawing tools, but I did learn some of the pen gesture shortcuts. Microsoft did a pretty good job in this tablet PC edition. Aside from the physical flexibility, I think it's like what you alluded to. We need to keep in mind the capabilities of the hand and pen in making better software and hardware and better using what we have. So I really appreciate your feedback there, Susan. It sounds like that Toshiba Satellite tablet PC really helps you out. That sounds cool. Listener Paul asked me a good question. He asked me how I clean my LCD screen. You may not know that you can actually damage an LCD if you use Windex or other ammonia-based LCD cleaner, so you have to be careful. It can actually scrape off some of the coating that's on LCDs. I'm personally partial to a product called Endust for electronics. It's not just a cleaning spray, but it's also anti-static, so it keeps the dust away for a little while. I still find myself dusting it with my fingers quite a bit. I turned my brother onto this, and he uses it on his big screen TV, and he swears by it for keeping the dust off. I use it not just for cleaning the screen, but also cleaning smudges and grime off the laptop case and the keyboard and wrist rests. You can find Endust for electronics at Amazon.com, and I put in a direct link into it in the show notes so you can check it out. The aerosol can is $5.38 US at Amazon, and there's also a small pump that's a little bit easier, maybe if you want to carry it in a laptop case. I used to buy it over at Office Max, but it looks like they may have discontinued it because they've got it on special secret sale, not in my area. One thing that Endust couldn't get off was the wrist rest grime on a white iBook. I don't know if you've ever gone into like CompUSA and looked at the iBooks, but they look really nasty where your wrist rests. And even though I would clean the iBook pretty regularly that my son uses, it still got kind of grimy. So I kind of stumbled across a kind of scary solution. Have you ever heard of the Mr. Clean Magic Eraser? It's this weird abrasive piece of foam that when it gets wet, you can use it to scrape dirt off of all kinds of weird things, like walls. I tried it on the iBook, and it did a beautiful job. Took it right off. It was really kind of wild. I mean, instantly cleaned it, and nothing else had really worked. I'd even tried like soft scrub and stuff like that. I wouldn't recommend you use it on any kind of shiny surface or slick surface because it will scratch it. I used it to get a line of ink off my HP printer lid, and it scratched it up a bit. It still looks better than it did when it had the ink on it, but it made me think twice about where to apply this cleaner. Mr. Clean Magic Eraser is available at grocery stores, drugstores, all over the place. Well, let me continue my MacBook Pro saga. Some of you may remember that shortly after I got the MacBook Pro, I mentioned that I was hearing a buzzing noise if my screen brightness was on anything less than full brightness. I was unable to capture this noise to play on the podcast, but it's a weird little zzz kind of noise that can be kind of grating if you're in a quiet room. In a noisy atmosphere, it's not a big deal, but when you're by yourself, it's kind of annoying. So I asked Apple to fix this while my computer was in the shop for the CD burning problem I had, but they didn't do anything about it. Got it back, same little buzz there. Research department Niraj was able to find an interesting temporary fix to the problem, and this fix does show that it's actually a software problem, not hardware. The fix is to open up Photo Booth. Remember that one, the really funny application I told you about that lets you make distorted pictures of your friends and families to embarrass them later? Anyway, if you launch Photo Booth, take a picture and then click on the picture, the buzzing sound goes away. How weird is that? I don't know how somebody stumbled across this. I guess the same way somebody figured out how to like eat artichokes. Anyway, if you don't click on the picture, it doesn't work. You have to click on the picture. I also he suggested a program called Quiet MBP from red-sweater.com that is also supposed to get rid of the problem. I looked for it and I tried to download it, but every time I went to download it, didn't actually function. So I read on this guy's blog quite a while ways, and he had started using an interesting solution. There's a widget called Mirror. It's kind of a narcissistic little thing. It basically uses your eyesight as a mirror. And before I tell you how it doesn't work, I want to tell you something else weird about it, is it made me think that my eyesight wasn't aligned properly, because when I look at the mirror, only half of my face is in it. Like I have to kind of move to a different spot off of dead center in order to be in the center of the mirror. I thought, oh no, maybe when I sent it back to Apple, they screwed up the eyesight. So I went into iChat and I popped open the video preview where you can look at yourself, you know, narcissist, we all like to do that. But anyway, I looked there and I was fine. I was dead center when I was dead center in the middle of the screen. So I'm not quite sure why this mirror widget is off center. That seems really strange. But the theory is that by bringing that mirror widget up, you can also make the buzzing sound stop. Well, after that long description I gave you, that didn't work for me. But a lot of people are swearing by that. So I don't know what's going on with that. The Windows implementation on my MacBook Pro seems to be working out pretty well. It came in really handy the other day when I ran into a catastrophic problem in Microsoft Excel. I had this Excel file that I'd worked on for a couple of days that was password protected. I'd saved it regularly, and I even changed the name every couple of hours just in case something got corrupted. It was that annoying of a file, I didn't want to have to do anything twice. I even put it off on a little drive partway through the work just because I wanted to make sure I didn't lose it. I emailed it to a guy I work with, and shortly after that, I could no longer open the file. Excel would start to open it, ask for the password, and then simply declare, unable to open file. This was a disaster of monumental proportions, as it was due to my boss by 6 p.m. that day, and it was already 3 o'clock. I called my coworker, and he was able to open it just fine on his PC. So I booted my Mac, booted into Windows XP, and tried opening the file in OpenOffice, and it worked. Huzzah! I wasn't completely out of the woods yet, though, because OpenOffice didn't seem to recognize all the graphs I had put together in separate tabs. But at least it was proof of concept that the file was indeed okay. I searched the web for over an hour to solution to this, and there were some hints that were in there, but nothing really point on of the kind of problem I was having. But it occurred to me that maybe the problem was the password, that something was funny going on with that. So I had my coworker strip off the password and email it back to me, and voila, it opened in the Mac without further effort. This was very cool to be able to diagnose the problem on a Windows machine, to be able to flip back and forth. But if anyone knows why Excel has this weird corruption problem on the Mac side and what else to do about it, I'd be delighted if you send me an email on that subject. My associate Chan suggested I try out the browser Camino. This browser uses the same Gecko rendering engine as Firefox, but it's already in a universal application which runs under both PowerPC and Intel under OS X. I'm sure glad that Chan suggested I load another browser because I didn't have enough browsers on my machine. Here's a nice compilation of all the browsers I have loaded on my system and why. If you're on a PC and running Internet Explorer, as about a third of you appear to be, I really encourage you to explore more modern and safer browsers. Not all of the ones I'm going to list below are available for Windows, but several of them are. Internet Explorer wasn't bad in its day, but it hasn't been updated in ages, and so it's missing many of the modern conveniences, like tab browsing, that most of us take for granted today. In addition, it has two features, ActiveX and VBScript. These two features allow a website to run an application on your computer. Now that sounds like a really good idea, because that'd be cool, they could provide all this content, they could run something and it's resident on your computer, it'd be fast, that's a great idea. It's only a good idea if there's no evil in this world. But unfortunately, there is evil in the world, and people exploit these services to run nasty bits on your computer instead. Please consider one using IE only for Windows Update and nothing else. Anyway, here's all the ones I'm running. Well, Camino is the one that Chan suggested, and I've added it to the mix, and it's pretty nice. It runs native, as I said, because it's a universal binary, so it's pretty fast. What I don't like is it doesn't accept extensions like Firefox does. Extensions are little tools people write to enhance the browsing experience. I've mentioned a really important extension a few times, the one that allows you to trick websites into thinking you're running Internet Explorer for Windows, so they'll let you into their website on Firefox. Not quite sure why that's necessary, but it seems to work pretty well. I haven't explored all the different options in Camino yet. I need to do that. Like I said, I kind of try things and I find out they're cool and then I move on, don't read anything more, but I will. I'm going to check more into that. In addition to Camino, I have loaded Safari, which is nice and fast. I'm not sure whether it's universal yet, though. It does have tab browsing and all that. And it actually comes from the KDE project, which was an open source project. Apple took their browser and tricked it up for OS X, made it all slick and fancy, and then gave it right back to the open source community so that they can continue development and other operating systems can get the advantage of that. So that was pretty cool. I run Firefox, which I actually like to run at the same time as Safari, swapping back and forth whenever one of them hits a bottleneck on a site, and, you know, I get bored really quickly. My friends say I just have ADD. Firefox does have those extensions, which makes it absolutely invaluable for me. I've loaded Flock, which I'm not really sure why I loaded that one, but I think it had some cool linkage into Delicious, which is a social networking bookmarking thingy, but it didn't entertain me for long because I haven't used it in ages. I have Mozilla loaded, which is the open source rewrite of the old Netscape tools, including Navigator for browsing, Mail and News Groups, which I never really got into, Composer, which is a nice free WYSIWYG web design tool that I use frequently, Address Book, and an IRC chat client. If you're looking for a product that embraces all of these things together, Mozilla is a great replacement for a lot of the tools that come on the Windows machines. You can use the Mail and News Group section for, it's like the old Netscape mail, except nice and pretty and new and fresh and all that. It's a great application. Of course, it's free. I have Internet Explorer on my machine. I have no idea why I still have that lying around. It never works to fix any of my problems, and it's old and archaic. It's version 5.2.3, which I believe is the last update Microsoft did in 2001. I have problems throwing things away, so I think that's why it's still there. I have SeaMonkey loaded, which looks an awful lot like the Mozilla suite, has the same sets of tools within it, but has a really cool logo, so I loaded it up. Very, very pretty. I'm not sure whether it's better or worse than Mozilla, but its Composer tool does seem to crash a lot for me, so I don't use it very often. The last one I have loaded is called Shira. That's S-H-I-I-R-A. And I know I only loaded that one because the icon looked cool. It's a dolphin fish spinning in the air over an egg, which might actually be like a grayscale globe that's shaped like an egg. I don't know, but it's really, really pretty. I don't even remember how the application runs. Next to browsers, my next favorite thing to mess around with and go to too many of them is search engines. Of course, I favor Google like most of you because it has a simplistic interface that means speed. And, of course, it has effective search results. I've also mentioned several times that I really like answers.com because it sorts the answers into search, the answers to a search into logical piles. Like if you look up the country of Estonia, it returns encyclopedia info, maps, local time, geography, all kinds of info, but piled up so you can find the category you were looking for before reading hundreds of links looking for your required content. You may have heard of a search site called Ask Jeeves, which was designed to allow the user to state their search query in the form of a question. Evidently, this didn't really pan out as a strategy. They haven't gotten much market share and lost a lot lately. So Ask Jeeves has actually dropped Jeeves from its name and logo and is now simply called Ask.com. They've added some really cool enhancements to their search results, which makes them worth a look. If you're using Firefox or Safari, but not Camino, doesn't work in Camino, when you enter a search term into ask.com and it returns its results, you'll notice a little pair of binoculars under each link. If you hover over those binoculars, a fairly large thumbnail view of the site pops up in a little window. This can be really handy to see if it's the right kind of site that you really wanted to go to. For example, how frustrating is it to you when you click on a search result and it takes you to that stupid about.com? You think it's a real result, but no, it's about.com, which is never what I'm looking for. I know I should be able to look at the URL and notice which one it is, but it always surprises me and I don't notice. But this would give you a visual right away to see if it's not what you want if you hover over the binoculars. Ask.com has also added a feature that gives you the option of narrowing or expanding your search. I typed in Lithuania, and it offered to narrow the search to maps, history, or government of Lithuania. Under Expand the Search, it offered several nearby countries, such as Latvia and our pals over in Estonia, as other places to search. I plan on trying out Ask.com some more to see if it provides a valuable experience. Maybe you'd like to check it out, too. If you do, send me an email at allison@podfeet.com and let me know if it helps you out. If you're a recent convert to the Mac, or you just look over at Windows machines with envy when you see how easily they can view photos from within the operating system, you might like an application called Phoenix Slides. This free software allows you to see your photos in a browser-like view with large thumbnails. And if you find a folder of pictures you like, you can launch a slideshow of that folder. There's also an option to include subfolders in the slideshow and make them show in a random order. It also shows you the full image information on each photo as you click through them, including make and model of the camera you used to take the picture, resolution, and exposure settings. You can rotate the image from within Phoenix Slides, which is really handy, because when you've just thrown them on your desktop, you never know whether you don't have them oriented right. But it also includes some rotations that seem less than useful, like flip horizontal or vertical. I hardly ever take a mirror image photo that I really need to flip. And then the ever-useful transpose flip diagonal. Why would you ever need to do that? That's like upside down and backwards. I am really clueless why you need that. But even more clueless, I am about two options called Make Progressive and Optimize Huffman Table. You know, I've always been concerned that my Huffman Table was less than optimized on my photos, so thank God that's there. Finally, you can reduce your photos to grayscale from within this application. It's a nice little 1.6 megabyte freeware tool that provides some really useful functionality. Again, it's called Phoenix Slides from blyt.net. That's blyt.net. Drop me an email if you know what Huffman Table optimization is. I bet one of you guys knows what it is. Well, my husband stumbled across a really strange thing that might actually be useful. He was upstairs playing around on his G5 Mac, and I was downstairs on my MacBook Pro, and we both happen to have iChat up. Since the MacBook Pro has a built-in iSat camera, it makes sense that I'm always shown as having video chat availability. But he noticed that he was showing video chat availability on his tower as well, even though he didn't have a video camera plugged in. Then he realized that his Hollywood DV bridge was plugged in. That's a FireWire analog to digital converter that he uses to convert the analog signal coming from a VCR tape to pull it into iMovie. That got him thinking. And so he plugged in his FireWire digital video camera into the FireWire port and pushed play on a tape in it. Then he called me into a video chat in iChat. And here's where it got cool. Since he was playing a tape, the tape played through his iChat into my iChat window. It was really confusing, of course, to me, because he didn't explain what he was doing. I just got this video chat window coming up with one of our home movies playing in it. It was probably because it was inside our home network, but the video looked excellent. The quality was just superb. I am not sure exactly what utility this discovery has, but maybe if you videotaped an event someone distant wasn't able to see, you could play it for them. This way you could force your home movies on relatives that thought they were safely far enough away. I read an article recently about a really cool use of digital technology in Wired magazine. It was about cop cars that have cameras mounted on the top and a computer in the trunk to help identify stolen vehicles. The problem this solves is that police officers on a patrol see a suspicious vehicle, and the passenger officer taps the license plate into the mobile data terminal mounted on the center console. The terminal then dials into headquarters and matches it against a list of stolen vehicles. In an entire night, they're only able to type in about 100 plates, and they usually get no hits at all. Civica, C-I-V-I-C-A, has developed smart cruisers, which instead have these four cameras, two on the roof and two pointing out the rear window. Each mount holds one standard camera and a second infrared digital video camera, along with an infrared strobe. The strobe flashes the street several times a second, highlighting the reflective surface of the license plates so that the IR cameras can see them. The standard video camera then grabs footage of the screen for visual reference. The IR cameras feed their image to a computer in the trunk, which does optical character recognition to identify the plate number and checks it against a hot list that's loaded daily into the car of the stolen vehicles and wanted persons. Inside the car, the officers can see the plate information and are given an audio alert if a match is found to the stolen vehicle database. This all sounds pretty high-tech and expensive, so the question is, does it really work? It turns out this setup typically processes 12 plates a minute in Los Angeles driving. Remember, the officers could do 100 in an entire shift. It turns out it's only limited to 12 plates because that's all they typically pass. Believe it or not, only 12 cars a minute in L.A. I could swear it was more than that. Oh, maybe the traffic's moving slow, so you only see 12. But anyway, this setup can actually handle up to 240 plates a minute, only limited by how many you pass. The result is that the officers driving these smart cruisers are now finding an average of 3 stolen cars a day, leading to roughly 12 arrests a month. I assumed this would be an enormously expensive tool, but they said that the city of Los Angeles is going to spend about $250,000 to outfit 19 cruisers by this summer. So that's only about $13,000 per cruiser, which really doesn't sound bad, considering you've got the cameras, you've got the IR cameras, you've got the infrared strobe, you've got a computer in the trunk, you've got a computer in the front seat. It looks like it's not going to be worth the trouble to steal that Chevy Impala I've been looking after for after they get these things out there. For Christmas, my friend Nancy gave me a gift certificate to CompUSA, and I finally figured out what I wanted to buy with it. I bought myself the Apple iPod radio remote. This is not to be confused with an FM transmitter that transmits the iPod tunes to a radio. It's the opposite. It turns your iPod Nano or 5th-gen iPod into an FM radio. This sounds kind of counterintuitive, like, you got an iPod, dude, why would you want to listen to radio? But it really does solve a problem for me. I work out at a gym that has a TV audio broadcast over FM frequencies, so you can hear the TV on your radio. I'm embarrassed to admit that I listen to and watch all my children while I run and do the Stairmaster. So for that reason, I've been dragging around an FM radio and an iPod. This will allow me to use one device for both. The radio remote only works with those two models, the iPod Nano and the 5th-gen iPod with video, because it uses the dock connector that is unique to them. Isn't it annoying how Apple is always changing the connectors on their devices? This is a particular pet peeve of mine, especially on how often they change the video connector on their computers. They change that more often than most people eat lunch. Anyway, back to the product review. Stop ranting. The radio remote is pretty cool. It's about an inch by an inch little square device that's white on one side with a circular control just like on the iPod Shuffle and has a center click button, volume control on the top and bottom of the ring, and then fast forward and reverse on the right and left sides of the ring. The remote comes with a set of headphones plugged into the top, but you can use your own as well. There's also a lock switch on the top, but there is no on-off switch because it turns out it's unnecessary. The remote has a brushed metal clip on the back so you can hook it to your clothes, I guess, and a classy-looking iPod logo. All right, enough with the remote. The coolest part is how it works on the iPod. When the remote is plugged into the iPod, magically a new menu item exists in your list. Below Artists, Albums, Songs, and Podcasts, you'll now see Radio. When you select Radio, you'll see the radio station displayed on the top half of the screen that you're tuned to, and the name of the radio station displayed below it. I assume that's only if they transmit that on the signal. To select a new station, you click the center button on the iPod, not the remote, which confused me, but the center button on the iPod, and then the display changes to an analog dial showing the frequencies across the bottom and a red line for the frequency you're sitting at, just like an old-fashioned radio. For those of you under 40, go ask your grandmother what I'm talking about. Anyway, if you use the click wheel on the iPod to move the red line, or you do use the click wheel on the iPod to move the red line showing the frequency back and forth to tune into another station. To save a preset station, you simply hold down the center button on the iPod. The stations you've chosen as presets now get a little triangle below them to identify them. To remove a safe station, you just reverse the process. Go to the station by clicking the forward or back buttons and hold down the center button again, and the triangle will disappear. So, you use the fast forward and rewind buttons on the remote or the ones on the iPod to click back and forth between the presets. You can turn the radio off but leave the iPod on by clicking the center button on the remote. I have no idea why you'd want to do that. Why would you want to keep your iPod on but turn the radio off? Why don't you just switch to music if you really wanted to keep it on? So it's kind of confusing that the center button on the remote is not what you use to set stations on the iPod. You do it on the iPod itself. I actually had to read the instructions twice to figure that out. I did it once, figured it out, but I couldn't remember because it wasn't intuitive, which is really not normal for an Apple product. I really usually hardly ever read the instructions, and if I read them, it's only once, not twice. One thing I read about this before I bought it was that people said that, in spite of what you might think, it was good because it didn't make for really long cables to tangle up. These people were lying. They're lying to you. They're all lies. This thing makes for a little under 6 feet of cables when you're done, from the end of the headphones to the end of your iPod. I'm not exaggerating here. It really cries out for a retractable cable mechanism. I think it's cool, but be forewarned about that. One question I meant to test before I did the review, maybe I'll bring it up next week, is where the information just got stored of the stations. Did that get stored in my iPod, or did it get stored in the remote? Can I take the remote and switch it over to my iPod with video, and it would have the stations I did on my iPod Nano? Well, that'll just be a little trailer to get you excited for next week. A teaser. My final review this week is not a tech gadget at all, but it's still a gizmo that makes my life easier, so I'm going to tell you about it. It's called the Easy Book Clip from easybookclip.com. That's the letter E-Z, or Z for you Canadians, bookclip.com. It's a wire spring that's in the shape of an upside-down T that you clip on a book to hold it open. The whole thing doesn't weigh more than like a half an ounce or a quarter of an ounce, but the spring is really strong, so it can hold open a stiff paperback book or a large hardback book. The softback books are the ones I have trouble with. They try to flip themselves closed, but this will really hold it open well. I've been using this thing daily at the gym to hold my book open while I work out on the Stairmaster. And I've been using it for like a year now, and I've given it away to my friends at the gym, and theirs are all still working great for them too. So it doesn't even wear out or get, you know, the spring doesn't stop it having enough stiffness. This would be useful enough all by itself, but the other thing it does is it acts as a bookmark that never falls out because it grips a section of the papers when you put it in. It's kind of hard to describe how this thing looks like, so you're going to have to go check it out yourself. But they only cost about $10 for two of them, or you can get a three-pack for $14. If you have extra money laying around, they even have fancier versions if you're into that. Well, looks like that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the NoSillaCast. Please keep your emails and comments coming. It's just so fun to hear your questions and comments on the cast. So please drop me a line at allison@podfeet.com or enter a comment on the show blog over at podfeet.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.